Yaakov instructs his children to descend to Mitzrayim. This is the first descent in the beginning of Miketz, to secure food during the famine. But when he instructs them, he employs a very strange verb. And Rashi senses there's something deeper to this mission. He instructs them, Lama Tisro. Hine Shamati, Ki Yeshever B'Mitzrayim, Redu Shama. A lot of strange words. Hine Shamati is if Yaakov himself had heard, it would appear that during a time of famine, if the entire family is suffering the lack of food, then word would have traveled fast. Others would have been aware independently that Egypt still had food, that Egypt still had provisions. So Yaakov is saying, Ki Yeshever B'Mitzrayim. Rashi interprets this as indicative of the fact that the famine really hadn't affected the Jewish clan. It's not clear whether whether the entire land of Israel was spared and immunized, or only Yaakov's family. But essentially, they had sufficient provisions, which, in and of itself, is an important turnaround in Sefer Bereishis. In Sefer Bereishis, keep in mind that Avraham and Yitzchak each experienced their famines. Avraham's occurs in Parshas Lech Lecha, Yitzchak's in Parshas Toldos, and it compels their departure from Israel. Yaakov is departing from Israel, but not based on famines. He departs his first time fleeing from Esav, and at this point, he becomes embroiled in Yosef's feud with his brothers, which ultimately lands him in Mitzrayim. But it's a very different story if Yaakov descends because of a famine, or if he descends because of some family tension and family competition. So Rashi says that the Jewish people had enough food. So if they had enough food, why descend to Mitzrayim? Remember, Yaakov doesn't know that Yosef's in Mitzrayim. Ultimately, as I said before, the entire family becomes entangled, and once Yosef's identity is discovered, it becomes obvious that Yaakov should be with Yosef for the final chapter of his life. But why does Yaakov dispatch his children if he has sufficient food? So Rashi says something very fascinating. Lama Tisro should be interpreted as not why should you delay, which is the second rendition of Rashi, but Lama Tiru Atzmachem, or Teru Atzmachem Bifnei Be'enei Yishmael U'Bnei Esav, Ki'ilu Atem Sve'im. You have sufficient food, but why should you, as we would say, rub it in their noses or rub it in their faces? The B'nai Yishmael and the B'nai Esav are suffering. They've been hit hard by the famine, and that calls for a more conforming behavior. If everyone's descending to Egypt to purchase food, you should descend as well, as we would call it Derech Eretz. Now, it seems from the Gemara as if at that point they had food, but perhaps at later stages they required the actual food in Mitzrayim. And certainly the Pasuk bears that out when Yaakov refuses to dispatch Binyamin when they return from their first trip. So the Torah begins, the entire scene has ground to a halt, and Binyamin and the brothers are still sequestered in Canaan, and Shimon is in prison in Mitzrayim, but Vaharav kaved me'od kaved baretz vahikash akilu lecholas hashever sherviu mitzrayim. And they no longer had their own produce, nor did they have the food that they originally retrieved from Mitzrayim in that first round. But at least this first round, the first descent into Mitzrayim, which is really the plot line, it drives the plot and it lends them to become further entangled. One could have questioned whether the Jewish people could have avoided Mitzrayim entirely had it not been for the Yosef component, had it not been for the struggle between Yosef and his brothers. In theory, you can imagine they could have secured food elsewhere supernaturally. So it's really not the famine that's drawing them down to Mitzrayim, but the saga of Yosef and Yosef and his brothers. But getting back to the B'nai Esav and B'nai Yishmael, they're suffering, and it's inappropriate for us to be living it up and flashing our independence and flashing our wealth and flashing our... And I think there really are two or three layers to this concern. Number one, there's a moral issue. Morally, people in your vicinity, people of your family, remember, B'nai Esav, B'nai Yishmael to us seem like very, very distant cultures, but for for Yaakov, it was his brother, and it was his nephews and his nieces and his great uncle's progeny. So it's not just family, obviously, but it's also people in your surroundings. When they're suffering, and when you're aware of their suffering, then your behavior should be, on the one hand, muted, and to just live off of your own produce would be almost mocking them and adding, as we would say in our terminology, insult to injury. They're suffering, and now they have to become envious of their brothers and sisters, so you want to ratchet it down or tone it down a little bit. But also, it's reflective of Yaakov's general conservative issue. We look back at the Avos and as if our selection and our status and our presence in Eretz Yisrael was a fait accompli and was, certainly at this stage, was already finalized and consolidated. But Yaakov's always worried, and he's worried in Parshas Vayishlach about the attack of Esav, and he's worried about his relations with the locals, and he's worried that if the Jewish people are seen as too successful and too flashy about their success, then it will incite hatred where it already exists. I mean, Lavan hates Yaakov, even though Lavan is equally successful. Esav has murderous intents towards Yaakov, and I think that in some of the triumphalism of our day and in the state of Israel, and certainly we've created a whole different modality as to how we interact with the world, and we want the people of the world to appreciate the state of Israel, to appreciate our success, there still is a place for being careful not to be flashy about it, and certainly when other people suffer, and when other people are unable to, and it's taken on a whole different tonality, because now we're not just presenting ourselves as a family or a clan, but as a nation state and as a people, and some level there is a Kiddush Hashem when the Jewish state can assist third world countries who suffer famines and lack of rainfall and other limitations which Israel technology has equipped both the state of Israel as well as people around the world to overcome. So it's not a situation or a condition where we can draw a direct analogy to Parshas Mikes into this Rashi, but it's certainly something which I think should inform us, not just morally, when people suffer, to be careful about it. I think that sometimes we're insufficiently careful about that, and Baruch Hashem, Jews have reached a state of affluence, and sometimes that affluence becomes very exhibitionist, which is concerning in and of its own right, even if people around you aren't suffering or undergoing trials. But certainly when people around you, and in the modern world of communication and internet and social media, the concept of around you is no longer limited to your immediate geographical proximities. Whenever there's suffering in the world, to be careful that your behavior doesn't express insensitivity towards that. There's another interesting word about Paro. When Paro awakens, so he's very disturbed, he's very troubled, he's, as we would say, vexed by the dream. And the Torah describes this with another interesting verb, vatipoem rucho. And Rashi cites the onkelos omitarfe ruche. He was troubled, he was, as we would say, crazy, obsessed, disquieted, unsettled. And the Torah describes this through the metaphor of a bell ringing. Mikashkeses bisocho. His spirit was resonating or was ringing, as we would say, for a bell. Kippa amon, as a bell. So what's interesting is that the lack of quiet and the lack of serenity and focus and calm is associated with two things. Is associated on the one hand with a lot of noise, the noise of a bell, and there is a sense of inner noise or inner quiet, and very often the way to achieve that quiet and tranquility is to eliminate the noise. It sounds cliched, but what's causing the distraction, what's causing this disconcerting sense of lack of stillness? Sometimes we have to find ways to quiet our inner world and our inner chambers. People that practice breathing exercises or yoga or other ways to achieve calm and serenity. And part of it is also that a bell is incessantly ringing, incessantly sounding loud noises in a way that's almost circular and cyclical. And the more velocity that the tongue or the clapper, which creates the sound, has on one side of the bell, just creates greater velocity for the pendulum to swing back and to hit the other side. And it just keeps sounding from side to side in a way that, at least psychologically for us, suggests obsessiveness and, as we would call it, OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder. Very often, when we lose our balance and we lose our clarity of thought and we lose our stillness, it's because we're not just facing issues that cause disquiet and, as we would say, noise and static, but it becomes obsessive and we feel ourselves swinging back and forth around the same issue and considering or obsessing about the two sides of an issue or the challenges of an issue. And sometimes the bell image creates not just the noise, but the cyclical obsessive nature. What's also interesting is that Rashi contrasts paro's disquiet and inner instability to Nebuchadnezzar. These dreams, these would be each foreign rulers whose dreams caused them, and in the case of Nebuchadnezzar, it didn't just cause temporary insanity or temporary frustration, but long-term insanity to the point that Nebuchadnezzar becomes raving mad after his dreams. And in Nebuchadnezzar's case, the word vatipaim is written with two tufts, vatispaim rucho. So Rashi explains, l'fisha hayusham shtei pimos, there were two issues, there were two bells ringing inside of him. He forgot his dream, and he also didn't know its interpretation. At least Paro was in touch with the dream. He had recalled the details, he just couldn't decode it. So he was moderately unsettled. Whereas Nebuchadnezzar actually forgot the details of the dream, and this caused him to be even further frustrated and inner and torn inside. And it reminds us that very often when we feel frustrated and emotionally stressed, it's because we're handling multiple issues and they gang up on us and they crowd us in. And sometimes the best way to resolve that psychological stress is just to separate the issues and to deal with each independently, even sometimes though they're related, as Nebuchadnezzar's two issues were related. But there's an enormity that we feel sometimes, and the challenge and the indomitability of our challenges, very often because they're multivariable, they're multifaceted, and if we just deconstruct them and separate them, they're sometimes easier to deal with. There's a final Rashi when this great encounter, not a final Rashi, but the final one I want to speak about, when this encounter between Yosef and his brothers occurs, they don't recognize him and he recognizes them. Vayakar Yosef v'esachav v'him lo hikiru. So Rashi, of course, the very famous Rashi, when he departed, they had been bearded, he hadn't been bearded, so his beard was new and therefore confused them. But Rashi interprets the word vayakar in his second interpretation, that the Torah is contrasting the offset between the pity and the mercy that Yosef would extend to them. Again, relative, he still manipulates the process, but ultimately he's merciful and compassionate, and the absolute brutality and mercilessness with which they treated him. So they didn't treat him as a brother, whereas he did treat them ultimately as a brother. And what's interesting is that compassion and mercy is described as recognizing. If you recognize someone, then you treat them with compassion. If you don't treat them with compassion, you don't recognize them. So there's an analogy between recognition and compassionate treatment. And very often when we're cruel, we don't fully realize the human being that stands in front of us or alongside of us, their frailties, their weaknesses, their good intentions. We don't give people benefit of the doubt. Very often we demonize people or we objectify people. Very often mass murderers and criminals have to dehumanize and depersonalize individuals because otherwise their crimes would be too monstrous, even for them, even in their psychopathic state. And even in more subtle crimes, we don't fully appreciate the person's perspective. We don't fully factor in when we feel hurt about people's behavior towards us. We're not fully recognizing whom they are, what their intentions are, what their limitations are, what this may have been a product of, and there's a disconnect between our interaction with that person as a human being with all the factors that human beings experience and carry in their lives, and we just see them as our enemies or as frustrating factors in our lives, and that allows us to treat them without proper compassion and sensitivity. So three Rashis. One Rashi, about how to behave when people around you are successful. Second Rashi about the inner loss of tranquility, likened to the ringing of a bell. And then finally, Rashi about the ability to recognize the humanity in people, to acknowledge and to identify the humanity as a wedge against cruel and inappropriate behavior. Shabbat Shalom.